Good evening, everyone. Welcome to part two of Great Decisions, or Great Decisions Part Two. Looking tonight at the Balfour Declaration, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, the Ilan Ishras Yonah Ben Rab Aryeh Leib. The Balfour Declaration was one of the fruits of World War I, and therefore we have to look first at that war, the Great War, to understand what happened, why, the issues, the acrimony. We'll show first three very short clips, again courtesy of the Destiny Foundation, to set the background. If someone could hit the lights, please.
Understood as a local. World War I can be understood as a local conflict that's not out of hand. In other words, what happened was that the great powers of Europe were drawn into a conflict as a result of a local political assassination. On a deeper level, this was a conflict among empires who were struggling for dominance over what we call today the Third World, the colonies and their resources. And also it was intra-European politics who would be the dominant power in Europe. And when the United States entered in 1917, it becomes in some sense a world war.
In July 1914, Austria declared war on Serbia and began to bomb Belgrade. And the alliances across Europe lined up to fight. Russia and France mobilized millions of soldiers, while Austria, Germany, and eventually England also mobilized their armies. On August the 2nd, Germany invaded France. And on August the 4th, England declared war on Germany after it had advanced into Belgium. The conflict would not be confined to European borders. On August the 23rd, Japan entered the war against Germany. It was a war on a scale that had never before been waged. Over 65 million troops were mobilized. The death toll would total almost 1 million after only 6 months.
Okay, that's the first. There are two other brief clips.
In October 1917, under General Sir Edmund Allenby, the British invaded Palestine. With the Allies on the advance, Jews did not remain passive. Zev Jabotinsky, the leading Zionist writer and activist, organized the Jewish Legion, and 6,500 young Jews volunteered to assist the British in attempting to expel the Turks.
Jabotinsky understood this was the right moment to strike while the iron was hot. Jabotinsky's position was clear. Only by fighting does a nation gain its independence.
At this time, 1.5 million Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were being systematically exterminated by the Turks. And the Jews of Palestine feared that they would face the same tragedy. It was only the capture of Palestine by the British that forestalled such a fate. On December 11, 1917, the triumphant entry of the British troops led by General Allenby into the old city of Jerusalem heralded a new era of hope for the Jews of Palestine.
Allenby leaned on the Bible. When he was ready to enter the old city, he dismounted from his horse and entered on foot because he did not want to appear as a conqueror, but rather a humble human being entering God's territory. Everyone within the Yishuv believed the aura, the biblical promise is going to be fulfilled. This is the divine hour. Now the Jews should stream to the Holy Land, because now the British will implement these things. And Jabotinsky and the others believed it as well. They were soon to be disabused of this hope. The British military soon enough turned against the Zionists.
The British supported Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca, and the head of the Bedouin Hashemite tribes. and assisted by the legendary Lawrence of Arabia, they revolted against their common enemy, the Turks. They subsequently swept the Turks out of the Arabian Peninsula and parts of Transjordan and Iraq. All three separate groups, the British, the Jews, and the Arabs, played a role in freeing Palestine from the grip of the Ottoman Empire. Each group with its own interests had territorial claims on Palestine. This would create a conflict of interest that continues to characterize the Middle East to this day.
Okay, and one more. Brief clip.
In 1917, for the Jews in Palestine, hopes flickered in the form of a letter written by the British Foreign Secretary and former Prime Minister, Lord Arthur Balfour, to Lord Rothschild of London, declaring that His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. A subsequent clause referring to the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine would foreshadow the stubborn underlying territorial conflict in the Middle East.
The Zionists hoped that the Balfour Declaration would in fact signal the mighty imperialism of Britain's willingness to carry out that pledge to create that Jewish national homeland in Palestine would be in fact implemented quickly, was soon to be dashed, those hopes falling on the rocks of British imperialism, strategy, Arab opposition.
Despite the Balfour Declaration and the seeming affinity of England towards Jews, German Jews remained steadfastly loyal to Germany during the war. Unaware, of course, of how Germany would turn on them just 20 years later.
Okay, lights please. Now we could flesh out some of the details and look at the warring context, the times, and the great decision that had to be made. Start with the Gemara Megillah, the Zayin Amud Beis. The Gemara says that Milchama Nami Adchalta de Geulahi, that war is also the beginning of the redemption. War, Rav Kook wrote in Arot, Mitorer Koach HaMashiach, it arouses the power of Mashiach, it's awakened. God is Matzmiach Yeshuot, Zoreat Zakot, Baal Milchamot. We say this in the bracha of before Kriyat Shema. God causes salvation to sprout. He sows righteousness. He's the master of war. And Rav Kook said, especially this war, Milchemet Olam Shel Achshav, this world war now, Tzipiya Noraa Gedolav Amuka Yeshba. It's filled with deep, awesome, colossal expectations, which point to, Rav Kook said, the revealed end of the exile with the settlement of the land of Israel. World War II took the world by surprise. In retrospect, like most things, you can connect the dots and see it coming. Europe was known for these cataclysms every 50 years or so. And so the causes of World War I, as you heard, are multifaceted. Strife in the Balkans, rivalries between the Germans and the Russians, and the Germans and the British, that broke down a balance of power arrangement that went back to the 19th century, the growth of nationalism, and simple miscalculations that were made on each side, or on all the sides. The trigger, as we know, was the assassination of the Austro-Hungarian Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand on June 28, 1914, in Sarajevo, by the Serbian nationalist Gavrilo Princip. He eventually rotted to death in Theresienstadt in 1918. He couldn't be executed because he was underage when he committed the assassination. His cell is still on display there. When Austria-Hungary declared war on July 28th, within a week, all of Europe was involved in the conflict. As we well know, that was the week of Tisha B'Av, Shavuot, Shechol B'Av, Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av was on the 4th, as you heard, August 1st. Germany invaded Belgium August 2nd, having declared war a day or two before. Turkey joined the war in November on the side of the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, and they fought against the Russians, the British, the French, the Italians, and other allied powers. Interestingly, Russia and Germany first tried to keep the war from themselves. The Tsar and the Kaiser were cousins. But it failed, and they could not prevent their countries from going to battle. Jews were caught in the middle, literally and figuratively, and taken by surprise like everyone else. How much were they taken by surprise? Agudas Yisrael convened its annual conference in Berlin in the summer of 1914, and that's when the war erupted. Rav Kook, who had attended the conference, was unable to return to Israel for 5 long years. He fled first to Switzerland, and then he lived in London, where he would have a role, a small role, in the Balfour Declaration. World War I was exceptionally brutal. The Germans immediately advanced into France through Belgium. There began repeated battles in which no side won an advantage, the battles of the Marne, of Verdun, and others. And World War I was a bridge between the old wars and the new wars. The technology surpassed traditional tactics. The sides engaged in trench warfare. You saw them just running across open battlefields that accomplished little but killed hundreds of thousands of men on both sides. More British and French died during the war than Germans. But in fact, close to 9 million people were killed in the war. Nothing by World War II standards, but unprecedented then. And the war saw the introduction of tanks, of aircraft, of poison gas that was outlawed after the war, and the extensive use of submarines. And the war had a fairly sudden end. The Tsar beat back the Germans, but couldn't suppress his own people. In March of 1917, he was forced to abdicate. Alexander Kerensky was halachically Jewish. His parents were Jewish, but not raised as a Jew, headed the interim socialist government. When Lenin came to power that fall in November, he right away made a peace treaty with the Germans. The Russians gave up parts of the Baltics, parts of Poland, all of which would foreshadow World War II. Peace offers on all sides, because the war was going nowhere, began to sprout already in 1917. With the war in the West going nowhere, soldiers began to mutiny. A German offensive in the spring of 1918 failed, and a British blockade began to have effects on Germany itself. On November 11th, armistice came into effect, with the oddity that Germany itself had yet to be invaded. The whole war was conducted in Western Europe, in France and Belgium, the Netherlands. It survived the war intact. Most of the fighting was in France, leading many Germans, including Hitler, Yimach Shemo, who fought in the war, to blame the Kaiser and the Jews for the treachery. Because to many of the people, it just seemed that the Kaiser surrendered suddenly and abdicated for his own good. The effects of the war were lethal. Jews across Europe suffered inordinately, not having a home and not being fully accepted where they lived. Eastern European Jews spent years on the run, trying to avoid the effects of the war. And the land of Israel was devastated during the war. We don't think about it. It's almost a closed chapter in history. But for perhaps the only time in this century, including the siege of Yerushalayim in 1948, during the War of Independence, people actually died in Israel, especially in Yerushalayim, of starvation, of malnutrition, of disease, typhus, malaria, cholera. Of 50,000 Jews who lived in Yerushalayim in 1914 when the war started, 18,000 died during the war. The 36% death rate. It's incredible. The percentage is astronomical. And the Ottomans deported Jews who had come from enemy lands, especially Russian Jews, and they looted the storehouses of Yerushalayim for their own needs. They prevented the importation of provisions from the Allied countries. Jews feared a massacre in the land of Israel. It was a time of great anxiety, of course exacerbated by the infighting among the Jews in Israel as to who would control the charity funds that were coming from abroad. And Jews found themselves on all sides of the conflict, fighting for the Tsar, for the Kaiser, for the Austro-Hungarians, and for the British and the French and later the Americans who entered the war in 1917. More than 1 million Jews fought in World War I on opposite sides, 40% of them for Russia. The post-war division of spoils reverberates until today. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was carved out with the volatile Balkans forcibly united in one country called Yugoslavia. That country, of course, collapsed 80 years later in the 90s amid terrible carnage. The Sykes-Picot Agreement, we'll discuss again a little later on, divided up the Middle East. Already in 1915, it was a secret agreement between the British and the French, with the French controlling an area north of Haifa to the Kinneret and north of that, meaning Syria, Lebanon, parts of Iraq, and the British controlling much of the territory south of that. Iraq was created in the early 20s by combining the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shia in one uneasy relationship that also hasn't worked out that well and hasn't been resolved. And of course, the Versailles Treaty stripped Germany of its arsenal, its resources, and its pride. It was humiliating, and that itself sowed the seeds of the next war. It was Chaim Weizmann who played the leading role in the Balfour Declaration, who recognized already in 1914 the opportunity the war presented, writing, "As soon as the situation is somewhat cleared up, we could talk plainly to England and France with regard to the abnormal situation of the Jews. Now is the time when the peoples of Great Britain, France, and America will understand us. The moral force of our claims will prove irresistible. The political conditions will be favorable to the realization of our ideal." When he said that, he was optimistic, maybe even Pollyannish, but much of what he said came true. Recall, of course, from the last time we were here, that after the death of Herzl, maybe for a decade, there'd been almost no progress in achieving the Zionist goal. So Herzl was right, but it was by no means easy. And complicating matters was the dispersal of the Jews. The Zionist movement was officially neutral in World War I, officially, but not in reality. Remember, each country had its own Zionist organization and Zionist leadership. The German Zionists were pro-German. Most of the Russian Zionists were also pro-German, not because they loved the Kaiser, but because they hated the Tsar. The pogroms, the poverty, the persecution had taken their toll, and they expected Germany to win. How much so? During the war, Aguda moved its headquarters from Poland to Frankfurt. The Zionists moved their international headquarters to Copenhagen. So that might have been reasonable, but they, the Russian Zionists and the German Zionists, were really cross purposes with the Western European Zionists. So they each did their own thing. At a certain point, each group played one off the other and their countries off the other. The result was a declaration that committed the British to seek the establishment of a homeland for the Jews in the land of Israel. So how did that come about? Really from nothing. The Balfour Declaration is inextricably linked to the efforts of Chaim Weizmann. He was born in Russia in Motul near Pinsk in 1874. He grew up in a religious home, attended yeshiva, and then completely went off the derech as a teenager, attending secular schools, university, living a dissolute lifestyle. When the Torah Jew falls, we really fall. So he became engaged to a woman, he lived with her for 4 years, and then became involved with another woman, broke up with the first, the second eventually became his wife, Vera. He was estranged from Judaism, and yet he, too, like Herzl, became committed to and obsessed with Zionism. So in fact, a marginal figure in the early years, even though he was mentioned, we spoke about him during the first lecture, he focused on founding a university of higher learning in Israel. The dream eventually became Hebrew University, but in an earlier incarnation, he was one of those responsible for founding the Technion in Haifa. And he made a reputation in the capacity of being one of the leaders of Russian Zionists in opposing Herzl on Uganda. But he didn't really have a leading role in the Russian Zionists. He was just one of them. He was there. So he naturally looked west for help. he trusted the British far more than the Tsar. Weizmann became a British citizen in 1910. He was a lifelong Anglophile. His son Michael, in fact, became an RAF pilot, Royal Air Force pilot, who was shot down and killed during World War II. And as we know, the Weizmanns are a family of pilots. His nephew, Asa Weizmann, was a pilot during the War of Independence and commander of the Air Force and president, etc. Weizmann became professionally famous before he was famous as a Zionist. By training, he was a chemist. He lectured in a number of European universities in chemistry until assuming a professorship at the University of Manchester. One of his discoveries played a critical role in the war. He developed a procedure for the production of acetone, a flammable liquid that the Allies used in their explosives. He used a certain bacterium and fermented it, and it became known scientifically as the Weizmann organism. He even became an advisor to the Admiralty in Britain. So popular mythology would have it that the British, looking to thank Weizmann for his contributions to the war effort, issued the Balfour Declaration. So Weizmann himself rejected that theory, writing in his memoirs, "I almost wish it had been as simple as that, and that I had not known the heartbreaks, the drudgery, and the uncertainties which preceded the declaration." In fact, we'll see Weizmann was actually disappointed in the declaration, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So what happened that suddenly interested the British in issuing such a proclamation? Why then not earlier or later? Who supported it? Who opposed it? Where were the Americans? Where were the Jews? Like Rav Kook anticipated, World War I unleashed forces of nationalism across the world, and especially resulted in the popularization of the Zionist movements. It began to attract supporters and sympathizers, especially among Jews who'd been indifferent just a year or two earlier. So typical of this phenomenon was Louis Brandeis, famous lawyer who was almost uninvolved in Jewish affairs in America, Kentucky native. But within a year of the war's outbreak, Brandeis became the leader of the American Zionists and close to Woodrow Wilson, the president. Wilson appointed Brandeis the first Jewish Supreme Court justice in 1916. So part of Brandeis's role was to get supplies to the beleaguered Jews in the land of Israel, but part also was Zionist activism with the American government. And Brandeis would intervene with the U.S. government and ask them to pressure the British whenever it became necessary. Another unsung hero, somewhat sung, was British. Unbeknownst to Weizmann, Herbert Samuel was a member of the cabinet of the Prime Minister then, Herbert Asquith. Samuel, of course, later the Governor General in Israel, beginning in 1920. It's a street named after him in Yerushalayim. For years, Samuel, with no relationship at all with Weizmann, was lobbying his colleagues in the cabinet to support the National Home for the Jews. So he didn't succeed at first. Asquith was dead set against it, but Samuel planted seeds that would flourish later. Later came when Asquith's government fell in 1916, largely because of his conduct of the war. It was a long stalemate, and that eroded his support. Asquith was succeeded by a conservative government of David Lloyd George, he of the Uganda Plan fame, and long supportive of Jewish rights in Eretz Yisrael. And he and Arthur Balfour, the new foreign secretary, were Christian Zionists. Balfour and Lloyd George, they were Bible-believing Christians who saw the Jews' return to Israel as the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy. How's that for irony? Most of the Jews, including Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, didn't believe that. But Balfour and Lloyd George did. Lloyd George also saw the advantages to Britain in expanding its empire, securing its territories in the Far East by controlling the Near East. It was one of those times when morality and politics coincided. So who was Balfour? Arthur James Balfour, 1848 to 1930, was a Scot, was a former prime minister. In fact, during the Uganda Plan, he was a prime minister. Longtime conservative leader, foreign secretary from 1916 to 1919. Obviously, it was an important post, less so, though, during wartime. And interesting, Balfour was not part of the war cabinet, and therefore was somewhat neutralized in his influence in the European theater. But here's the irony. But for his declaration, he would mostly be forgotten. Yet, as a Christian Zionist, a most romantic and enthusiastic breed, Balfour was already interested in solving the Jewish problem as prime minister, hence the Uganda plan. Weizmann opposed the Uganda plan. The first time he met Balfour was in 1906, and Balfour asked him what he have against East Africa. Why is East Africa insufficient? And Weizmann writes in his memoirs that he said, turned to Balfour and said to him, "Mr. Balfour, supposing I was to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it?" He sat up, looked at me and answered, "But Dr. Weizmann, we have London." "That is true," I said, "but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh." He said two things which I remember vividly. The first was, "Are there many Jews who think like you?" I answered, "Weizmann, I believe I speak the mind of millions of Jews whom you will never see and who cannot speak for themselves." To this he said, "If that is so, you will one day be a force." This is 1906. Of course, Balfour didn't know it, but it was not on the mind of millions of Jews, not even of a majority of Jews at that time, and probably not even during the war. There are opponents to what was happening in London at the time, to the Balfour Declaration, with British Zionists pushing for a British commitment for the establishment of a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland in Eretz Yisrael. The opposition did not take long to coalesce and to present a countervailing view. The opposition was not united, but it did exist. So, for example, in the United States at the time, the Zionists were very few in number, and American interest in such a declaration was stoked only because of the relation of Brandeis and then Felix Frankfurter to President Wilson. Now, Wilson had a religious interest in a Jewish homeland and a political interest, as we saw at the Paris Peace Conference, in rewriting the world's map to ensure the spread of democracy. But there was pushback in the U.S., mainly from Reform and or assimilated Jews who greatly feared that Zionism would arouse accusations of dual loyalty, which is a uniquely Jewish malady that does not seem to afflict any other ethnic group in the United States. Remember that American Jews were not necessarily pro-British or anti-German. Indeed, before the U.S. entered the war, certainly before Lusitania was sunk, there was strong Jewish support for the Germans. And again, not because they loved the Kaiser, but because they hated the Tsar. Most of the immigrants we'll see next time were Russian Jews. The dominant view amongst American Jewry was anti-Russian. And the British were allied to the Russians. The Germans were fighting the Russians. Therefore, most American Jews had little sympathy for the British and none for the Russians. Millions of Jews had fled the Tsarist tyranny and rejoiced in his defeats. In the end, Wilson disappointed Brandeis and Frankfurter, not issuing an American declaration which they sought, and apparently Wilson was convinced by Colonel House, not his aide, not to publicly support even the British declaration that was being planned. House said it was just British imperialism that America should not endorse, but through a back channel, Wilson informed the British that he would not oppose their declaration. British Jews were also not uniformly supportive of a declaration, and there was public Jewish opposition to it. Weizmann even factored in the opposition of British Jews in his calculations. At first refusing to meet, at first, Herbert Samuel, whom he assumed was one of those assimilated Jews who would have no use for Zionism, only to be surprised at their first meeting when he realized he had completely misunderstood Samuel. Samuel was the home secretary. He had grown up in a religious home. He renounced the Torah when he went to university. I think it was either Oxford or Cambridge, except he was Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus his whole life. A strange way to renounce the Torah. But when Weizmann met Samuel, Samuel said to Weizmann, to quote, he said, "Think big. Think big, not small. Think of a Jewish state. with British support, and not just a vague declaration about a homeland. So I mentioned before, Samuel became the High Commissioner in the Land of Israel in 1920, served for 5 years, actually lived a very long life, died in 1963. In 1915 already, Samuel recommended to the cabinet that a British protectorate be established in Eretz Yisrael, and Herbert Samuel then became the chief guide to Weizmann on how to maneuver the cabinet toward a more Zionist orientation. It was not an easy road, nor was it a one-way street. Not everyone was as sympathetic as Weizmann hoped. The Prime Minister in 1915, Asquith, was completely uninterested, and Weizmann's efforts went nowhere. Meanwhile, the leaders of British Jewry were mostly antagonistic. Principally, Claude Montefiore, who was the great nephew of Sir Moses. Moses never had any children. And the journalist Lucien Wolfe, who actually wrote publicly that he assumes that the English perceive his hostility to Zionism as a sign of his, what he called, superior loyalty, that he's not going to be seduced by something Jewish, but he'll show them how British he is by opposing Zionism. Reformed Jews, liberal Jews in British parlance, were anti-nationalistic. There was some Orthodox opposition in Britain as well. The best Weizmann could do was convince these liberals to support the philanthropic aims in Eretz Yisrael without any political dimension. But they lived in fear, these Jews, real fear, that any Jewish state would undermine the rights of Jews in exile, the hard-earned rights of Jews in the exile, and so they were unalterably opposed to any resolution that would or might impact those rights or even demand the allegiance of all Jews to that state. Some Brits opposed Zionism because of the German Zionist connection, fearing the Zionists were German agents who would weaken the war effort. There was another group that was opposed, as you saw in the video. The Arabs were opposed, and they constituted a growing but influential force. So their contributions to the war effort were also noted, primarily in the Arabian battles of T. Lawrence of Arabia. He later took on the name Peter O'Toole later in life. He fought with the Emir Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca, to rid the Arabian Peninsula of the Turks. Lawrence's great fortune, he was a big PR guy himself. He wrote extensively about his exploits, obviously embellished it, but he was brought to world renown. He had his own publicist, Lowell Thomas, the famous American journalist, who also exaggerated what he did. But he did fight. Lawrence fought in Aqaba, in Transjordan, in Damascus. In the end, the Turks were defeated, and Lawrence expected the Arabs to be rewarded with independence in these regions. That's when the release of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, the secret treaty of 1915, Sykes was the Brit, Picot was the French secretary, dashed Lawrence's hopes. The territory, they divided the whole area. The French received Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, part of Iraq. The British would occupy the Arabian Peninsula, much of Iraq, part of the Land of Israel. The Russians claimed a share, mainly Iran. They'd never be able to implement because of the revolution. With most of the Land of Israel, under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, coming under international rule, because both the French and the British wanted it and could not decide how to divide it. Of course, this was their dream. It was never fully realized, but the Arabs raised their claims as well that were eventually accommodated in part. The problem was, as Sykes and Picot are making their agreements, there was a separate agreement that was being made between Henry McMahon, who was the British High Commissioner in Egypt, and this Hussein ibn Ali, the Sharif of Mecca, in which McMahon promised the Arabs their independence after the war if they fought with the British. So in fact, the British were making conflicting promises, and they would just make another one to the Jews. It was never carried out fully, although Hussein ibn Ali was crowned the king of the Arabian Peninsula after the war. He could not sustain his rule there. He was driven out in 1924 by Abdul Aziz ibn Saud. You may know the name, the founder of the Saudi dynasty, who had, I think, 80 or 90 children from 30 wives, and some of his children are still alive. They're the successions of kings now that you have in Saudi Arabia. He was quite the ladies' man. Now, this Hussein ibn Ali was kicked to the north, and he was compensated with Transjordan. His son was Abdullah, the king during the War of Independence. He was grandfather of King Hussein of Jordan, the great-grandfather of the present king. Now, importantly for our discussion, Sykes, of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, himself became an ardent Zionist, and he urged Weizmann to continue to pressure the government, which he did as well. He was then secretary to the War Cabinet. Sykes also perceived the Jews as better allies than the Arabs and much more amenable to furthering British interests in the region. And Sykes also regretted giving away, so to speak, so much to the French, and he was looking to assert British hegemony in the land of Israel and elsewhere. At the same time, and this is part of the intrigue, separate overtures were being made by the Zionists to the Turks. Notwithstanding their setbacks and their brutality in the land of Israel, they were still sovereign. And they wanted the Turks to make a declaration about a Jewish homeland, and then the Jews would support them. Overtures were made to the Germans as well, to the Kaiser, that he'd receive greater support from the Jews if he would preempt the British and issue his own declaration. And operating against the Zionists was the simple fact that there was a devastating war going on with unprecedented carnage, and Zionism was not at the top of anyone's agenda. But they forced it again and again before the British cabinet until it bore fruit. So what exactly happened? Some British politicians wanted the cover of other nations and their support, but what led to the declaration was in fact a confluence of events. Unique. The rise to power suddenly in December 1916 of Lloyd George and Balfour. The British interest in securing the Middle East for their own post-war ambitions. Both were indispensable. It was both religious and opportunistic, and made easier by the concurrent British military successes in Sinai in 1917, even though they were defeated several times by combined Turkish-German forces in Gaza. But by mid-1917, General Edmund Allenby would take command. Within a year, the Turks would be routed from the land of Israel. Once the British decision was made in April 1917 to conquer Eretz Israel, ironically the same month in which the U.S. entered the war, the Zionists intensified their activities. It also helped that, as you heard, Zev Jabotinsky's Jewish Legion, which went by the name Zion, the Zion Mule Corps, not because mule was a synonym for tank, but because they rode mules, they fought alongside the British, first at Gallipoli, later though in the land of Israel, at Megiddo and the Jordan Valley, all against the Turks. Beginning in April, Weizmann met repeatedly with Lloyd George and Balfour. He began to speak publicly about the creation of a Jewish national home, and he saw the publication of a favorable editorial in the Times of London, of all places, supporting such an endeavor. That right away attracted the antagonism of the Jewish anti-Zionists, whom Weizmann had ridiculed as a small minority. And Montefiore and others published their own op-ed in the Times of London stating their firm opposition to Zionism and to a Jewish state, and even to Jewish nationalism, asserting that Judaism was a religion only, and the nationality of the Jew was whatever nation he resided in. And they said a Jewish state would be a calamity for Jews in other countries. Well, this public airing of grievances backfired, and Montefiore was rebuked by the chief rabbi, by others. Their criticism had to be muted. It aroused even greater support for Zionism amongst the average British Jew. But even that didn't help Weizmann internally. Once, in fact, even resigned his position as the head of the British Zionist foundation, because the general Zionist leadership resented him, resented being kept out of the loop. They were critical of his arrogance, of his heavy-handedness, of the slow pace of progress, and especially critical of Weizmann's supreme confidence, which, by the way, would continue to 1948, that the British were the only guarantors of Zionist success. Weizmann put every egg in the British basket. At the same time, in the spring, late spring of 1917, after America entered the war, President Wilson sent an envoy to the Turks to try to make a separate peace with the Ottomans, with whom America had no quarrel. They were going to fight the Germans. Of course, that would be devastating, because if America then made an agreement with the Turks, invariably the agreement would involve American support for Turkish rights in the Middle East. Weizmann tried to prevent the meeting from taking place between the American envoy and the Turks. Fortunately, the envoy was a Jew. It was a former ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, son of the famous later during the FDR administration. Weizmann intercepted him in Gibraltar, convinced him of the futility of his mission, and nothing came of it. He never, in fact, met with the Turks. Meanwhile, the Russian Zionists, who were anti-British because the Brits were aligned with the hated Tsar, they were irritated by Weizmann. The Kerensky government, the provisional government after the Tsar was kicked out, was more sympathetic to Zionism but was extremely weak. So in effect, the Russian Zionists were marginalized. In July of 1917, the British Zionists submitted a draft text to the cabinet calling for the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael as an essential post-war objective. That too was controversial. Nochum Sokolov, who was the assistant to Weizmann, opposed asking for a state, saying, Tafasta meruba lo tafasta. If you ask for too much, you wind up with nothing. A bit of Talmudic wisdom that echoes throughout the 20th century. I'm just reading a few weeks ago. After the Yom Kippur War, when Kissinger began his shuttle diplomacy, he wanted to make peace throughout the region. And Dayan, in a meeting, just said, Tafasta meruba lo tafasta, and explained it to Kissinger, who said, I understood the original Hebrew. If you look for too much, you wind up with nothing. Sokolov felt that you could build on a simple declaration of intent, as long as it's not, but you can't build on an outright rejection. Several drafts were circulated, and again a choice had to be made. When to ask, whom to ask, what to ask for. A state, a homeland, a sanctuary. Weizmann favored asking for a state, while Lord Rothschild, who was the head of the Zionist Federation in Britain, thought moderation was critical, a national home. As the Jews argued, the British debated. President Wilson was noncommittal. Balfour argued before the cabinet, if the British don't issue such a declaration, the Germans will, and that itself will harm the conduct of the war. Some cabinet ministers were unalterably opposed, including a Jew, Edwin Montagu. Some saying that Eretz Yisrael was not large enough for the Jews, not fertile enough to support Jewish immigration. On October 31st, 1917, the cabinet voted and authorized the Balfour Declaration, a letter to Lord Rothschild of the Zionist Federation. And the draft was likely the final product of Balfour and Sykes and Weizmann and Sokolov, and then it went through any committee. It was released to the public on November 2nd, 1917. And here I have the original right here. I have to return it after this year. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. This is the quote. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. End quote. And Balfour ended, I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. And he signed it. Note the compromises a national home, but not a state. So Weizmann initially was not happy with the product. But a national home is also more than a homeland. But it said a national home, not the national home for the Jewish people. And the declaration stated that nothing would, quote, prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, meaning the Arabs, who would greatly obstruct the implementation of the Balfour Declaration. And nothing that also nothing that would prejudice the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. And that was a bone that was tossed to the British anti-Zionists. But despite the mixed reaction of the leadership, Jews rejoiced. And most saw this as an epic historical event. German Zionists rejoiced, and right away they ran to the Kaiser and offered that the Kaiser should issue a similar declaration. Didn't happen. The French opposed it because it now gave the British the upper hand in the land of Israel. That was a deviation from the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Wilson did not endorse it until a year later. The new communist government in Russia, of course, rejected it outright. What's the aftermath? A little over a month later, as you saw in the film, General Allenby, who also has streets named after him in Tel Aviv and Haifa and the bridge over the Jordan, captured Yerushalayim for the British, entering the old city on foot, not horseback, out of respect, and proclaiming, "We have come not as conquerors, but as deliverers. It is our intention to open a new era of brotherhood and peace in the Holy Land." Well, it didn't quite happen. The Arab world did not respond well, except for one aberration that is so tantalizing in retrospect. So they felt betrayed by the British, even though Weizmann and the British claimed that Eretz Yisrael was excluded from the land that was to be Arab and independent, but McMahon promised the other land, not this particular piece of land. By 1920, they would be rioting and murdering Jews in Yerushalayim. But in 1919, Weizmann signed an agreement with the Emir Faisal, who was one of the sons of Hussein ibn Ali. This is the Faisal who later became the king of Syria and then Iraq, in which the Zionist organization would recognize and support Arab independence in Arabia in exchange for Arab support of Zionist ambitions in Israel. That was the famous Weizmann-Faisal correspondence that was duly signed at the Paris Peace Conference. In a separate letter to Felix Frankfurter, Faisal wrote, I quote, "The Arabs, especially the educated among us, look with deepest sympathy on the Zionist movement." Then he went on to say that this will be for the benefit of both peoples. And he also said before the conference, the two main branches of the Semitic family, Arabs and Jews, understand one another. And I hope that as a result of the interchange of ideas at the peace conference, which will be guided by ideals of self-determination, nationality, each nation will make definite progress towards the realization of its aspirations. Think about it. It was the only time that an Arab leader actually acquiesced to the ambitions, the aspirations of the Zionist movement, and did not at all claim any residual Arab rights in the land of Israel, except their agreement says that the Mohammedans will retain exclusive responsibility for the Mohammedan holy places. The boundary of that state that Faisal agreed to was today's Israel, plus stretching to just south of Sidon, Sidon, in southern Lebanon, including the Golan Heights, and between 5 or 10 miles on the east bank of the Jordan River, all the way down to Aqaba, today Eilat. And Faisal blamed the Turks for fomenting strife between the Jews and what he termed the local peasants. The local peasants who lived in the land of Israel, at the time there was not yet such a thing as Palestinian nationalism. That's an invention later in the century. Well, had the agreement been implemented, the 20th century might have been completely different and a lot less bloody for Jews. But it stalled only because the British failed to implement Arab independence, and then the agreement fell apart. Leading us to the words of the poet John Greenleaf Whittier, "For all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been." the poet Whittier, after whom the Whittier School is named, where we cannot vote tomorrow. Still in London, Ralph Cook was asked to speak about the Balfour Declaration at a public celebration. Spoke in Hebrew, was translated, words that Rav Herzog would later echo to Harry Truman. And Rav Cook said, "I did not come here to thank the British Empire. Rather, I came to congratulate it on being chosen as God's agent to fulfill his promise to bring us back to the land of Israel." The Haredi world was thrown into turmoil in a way that it, from which it has not yet fully recovered. The Balfour Declaration seemed to contradict their doctrine that no good would ever come from Zionism. That was an anti-Torah movement that was doomed to failure and self-destruction. As late as 1937, Rav Isaac Breuer, as Rav Hirsch's grandson and the brother of the Rav Breuer from Breuer's here in the Heights, 1937, he asked the Shaila to the Moetz Gedolei HaTorah. He was the head of part of the Gudas Yisrael, Rav Isaac Breuer, the school why he was named for him also. Asked the Moetz to decide once and for all, was the Balfour Declaration Minat Shemayim, or was it Masa Satan? Was it divine, or was it satanic? And they refused to answer the question. Then, in 1917, even today, to a large part, so part of the Torah world effectively marginalized itself. Yet it didn't have to be. No less a personage than the Ar Sameach, Remer Simcha Kohen of Dvinsk, author also, of course, of the Meshech Chochma, he wrote that the importance of the Balfour Declaration was that it circumvented the problem of the three Shavuos from the Gemara Ksuvah, Saf Kufiyat Aleph, Amud Aleph. That one of the three Ksuos enjoined the Jewish people, Shelo Ya'alu B'choma, that we're not allowed to conquer the land of Israel by force. However, the Ar Sameach wrote, however we understand the oaths, literal or not, they lapsed with the Balfour Declaration. Because the world, so to speak, effectively gave permission to the Jews to return to the land of Israel. The Haredi world, the old Yishuv, could have latched on to the Ar Sameach. They didn't. They went as far as negotiating with the Arabs for Arab sovereignty in the land of Israel as long as they would allow Jewish immigration and Jewish life to continue unmolested. Of course, nothing was ever simple, and despite the hoopla and the celebrations of the Balfour Declaration that took place for decades, even today, this week, it's 95 years since the Declaration, the Balfour Declaration was essentially renounced by the British before World War II. Of course, the ambiguity in the Declaration engendered much of the ensuing strife. Did the British commit to a state? Not necessarily. Do the Jews have to be careful not to prejudice the civil rights of the Arabs? Yes, but how do you not prejudice them if there's to be a Jewish state? And of course, notice the word used, Palestine, in Palestine. What's Palestine? There's no territory was delineated in the Declaration. Many Jews assume once the British were awarded a mandate over Palestine by the League of Nations in 1920, then the Balfour Declaration applied to the entire area of the mandate, which encompassed most of Transjordan as well. That certainly didn't happen. And by 1922, the new colonial secretary, Winston Churchill, just carved that whole area out of mandatory Palestine and awarded it to Hussein of Mecca as a consolation prize. That's 80% of the British mandate in Palestine. That, of course, gave rise to two things. One is the famous Beitar song written by Zev Jabotinsky, Shtei Gadot LaYarden. There are two banks to the Jordan. Zo Shalanu, Zo Gamke. This is ours and that one too, because that was the mandate on both sides of the Jordan River, and of course to the current slogan as well, current events, Jordan is Palestine, that a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River would be the second such state in the region, because the first state is already the mythical kingdom of Jordan. But the main problem would remain the British, changes in government, persistent Arab riots and threats, Jew hatred, all led the British to restrict Jewish immigration into the land of Israel beginning in the 1920s and to shelve any plans for statehood, all culminating in the British white paper that effectively terminated Jewish immigration after 5 years and ended all talk of statehood. And then the war broke out. In effect, the Balfour Declaration died in 1939. Nevertheless, the moment remained a source of great hope and encouragement for Jews. The first time a government had decided to establish a Jewish home in the land of Israel with practical and positive plans for implementation, it would diminish the voice of the anti-Zionists, it would reinvigorate the Zionist movement with clear purposes and a realistic vision. So even today, it remains a watershed moment in Jewish history. I thank you all very much. So we leave the European theater for a time, I think the next 2 weeks, and next week we're going to look at the great decisions, to leave or not to leave, the great Jewish migration from Europe in the 30, 40 years, from 1880 to about 1914, when millions of Jews left Europe. We'll look at why then, why they went where they did, why they moved before, or stay. Why did some Jews stay? We'll look at all the factors in Jewish immigration, and the week after that, we'll look at another great decision for those Jews who came to America. What would their spiritual life be? What choices did they have to make? How did they choose? Most didn't choose that well, but that all to be discussed. Thank you very much.